Admiral Balfour, Reel 3.
So there was a Lynx helicopter on the Baring returning from a surface search mission. She got the fright of her life because they have an electronic warfare warning system and had detected our 909 radars and thought that we had acquired the helicopter. So we shouted at her on a circuit to freeze and climb because we knew the raid was below and get out of the way. I don't think they ever heard that. But anyway, we were content that she had been warned to keep out of the way. And anyway, I was quite happy that I wasn't going to hit a helicopter. The Venger, on the other hand, we didn't know what to do about. There wasn't time for her to get out of the way. So we learnt a very important lesson, that even in war, your safety procedures are as important as in peacetime, and probably more so. Because the one thing that was going through my mind is, if I fire at this raid, which I was going to do and had no question about that, was I going to fire a missile straight through a Venger? So we fired the first missile at the first target, and then a second, and I was quite happy about that. And then we know we hit one A4, and we're 100% certain we hit the second A4, and it was not Avenger's guns that hit it. Avenger was totally unaware at this stage that there were Sea Dart missiles flying over her. I did not know what the missile profile was. It takes off from the ship, a great whoosh of steam, and goes up quite high and then comes down because the aircraft, the target, was at 50 feet. We knew that, very low. But we didn't know where it was going to come down. So I just prayed to God, really, and thought, well, now I've got to go for this raid, or Avenger's going to get sunk, or somebody, or me. So we've got to go for it and just hope to God we don't hit Avenger. And she was slightly off the bearing. And these missiles fly down a beam, and so 1 degree is enough. But it taught us all a very important lesson, that you really do have to worry about safety, and it came in handy later. So as the raid came in, we became aware that there were more than just a missile. We didn't know they were aircraft until Avenger reported that she was being bombed. Now, another problem occurred here. In a modern operations room, you are blind from the daylight point of view. You don't really know if it's day or dark half the time. And the thing that we forgot to do was to feed the bridge, the officer watch, and of course at action stations, the first lieutenant was on the bridge. And they could actually see what was happening 7 or 8 miles away. It was still daylight. And it was a source of information which I dearly would have liked to have had. This nowadays is cured by the fact that all weapon systems have an infrared and low-light television system on them. So that is extremely helpful in clarifying what's really going on. But at the crucial moment of setting off these missiles, we weren't sure whether we had more missiles or whether we had aircraft until Avenger reported she was being bombed. So we were convinced we'd hit two targets and had fired at a third. We were also pretty sure that the missile was not going to fly the full length. We were fairly confident that the missile had been launched at about 25 miles, that sort of distance, which is roughly the sort of range of an AM-39. However, we weren't taking any risks. We had turned downwind, gone up to about 20 knots because it was blowing quite hard. We'd stowed all our chaff. And one of the effects of this is if you fire three Sea Dart missiles, all the efflux stays with you if you're going downwind, and you disappear in a cloud of smoke. And we think this is what the Argentinian A4 pilot who survived saw. Was Exeter going downwind, covered in smoke, when actually thinking that it was invincible and they'd hit it. And they were absolutely convinced that they'd hit invincible, but they hadn't. Invincible, at this stage, was still about 20 miles away, and completely unworried. Now, the excitement of being attacked is worth a word or two. As I said earlier, the role of the captain starts to diminish, apart from suddenly realizing about safety and sorting that out, and keeping an eye on what was going on, and trying not to shout at the team to do things faster than they possibly could. And one knows in future, another occasion, that to keep a little calmer. But the thing you can do is to tell the ship's company what's happening. And this I did. I did a sort of countdown on the general broadcast, so everybody in the ship knew what was going on. And then I said, right, we've got, it's now, the missile's 10 seconds away, count to 10, if there isn't a bang and you're still there, breathe a sigh of relief. And apparently this created a considerable amount of mirth. And anyway, immediately this engagement was over, the aircraft had flown over Avenger, two had been shot down, the bombs had missed, and the two others turned away. And we locked on again, and I had a difficult decision. So far, we'd been in the area for now nearly 8 days, and we had not been able to top up our Sea Dart missile. We'd only got a few on board, and I didn't know whether to spend more missiles firing at a target going away, which is no longer a threat, or whether to conserve ammunition. And I didn't know when I was going to be able to transfer missiles at sea. I'd been trying to get them for 2 or 3 days, but the weather had prevented it. So I was down to 10 missiles from 20, and now I was down to 7. And I didn't know what to do. And this was all part of the problem of leaving the West Indies in a peacetime environment and not being able to top up with ammunition until I got down to the war zone, and then being too busy to do it there. So I decided to have a go, but at that moment, the two Harrier Cap, which had been scrambled against the raid, were chasing the A4s, and although I knew they wouldn't be able to catch them, I was unable to be 100% certain that there was no danger of my shooting down a Harrier instead of the A4s, and so I let them get away. I don't regret that, but sometimes I think to myself, it would have been very nice to have hacked the other two. It would have really been a good day. I suppose it's like missing the last pheasants in a drive. But you can't risk shooting your own aircraft down. And a point of procedure came out of this, which was a lesson in itself, that we had been arguing for some time, the DDGs, that when the CAP was operating against the force, defending the force itself rather than going into the Falklands, control of those aircraft should be passed to the DDG, who had air controllers on board, who could then deconflict the aircraft in the operations room in which the battle was being fought. Had I had control of those Harriers, rather than Invincible, on that day, I would have hauled them off and fired, because I knew they couldn't catch them. The two aircraft at the same speed, they hadn't a hope. But I had a hope, and I think A4s in the sea can't come back another day. So it was an extremely interesting 6 minutes, that's all. It felt like 6 hours, but it was only 6 minutes. And we were very proud that the ship had been able to carry out the engagement in such a controlled way, despite the safety problems, and despite the sort of never having done it before. And we reflected on, with gratitude on the excellent training we'd had with the Americans, which no doubt at all had stood us in good stead. But there was one final little caveat at the end. As soon as the raid was over, and I told the ship's company that it was all over and they could relax and well done, about a second or two later, my petty officer steward, Professor Allen, appeared in the operations room with a glass of whiskey on a silver salver. Now, this was most extraordinary. I couldn't work out how he'd done it so quickly, because although he's very good on the golf course, he tended to take his time on things like this. And I couldn't work it out, and everyone was amused, so I drank the whiskey with a shaking hand and felt much better for it. And I know there were an awful lot of people in the ops room who would willingly have had the same. Until about 4 or 5 days later, the story came out that Benos Allen had crept up to my cabin to see if all was secure. When we had said, hit the deck, which you did just before a missile, so that people weren't thrown off their feet with an explosion, he hit the deck right in my cabin on a soft carpet, found that his head was very close to the bar cabinet, and when the raid was over, unlocked the door and helped himself to a glass of whiskey, thought that's very unfair, put more in another glass and rushed down to the ops and gave it to me. But it had a remarkable effect on the ship's company. Morale was very high, having done it, but the whole ship then relaxed, and I think sort of these vignettes of humour are written all through these sort of incidents, and they're extremely good for people's morale, and we were really had our tails up. On reflection of this incident, the really sad thing was that although all these ships have computer systems to run their warfare and their weapons, we had not got a recording package designed to record what the system had seen. We did have a recording package, but it was for test firings, and it used an enormous amount of computer storage space, and of course you couldn't use that in an operation. And it would have been extremely helpful in analysis of what really happened and how did the system perform if we had been able to record, say, every 15 seconds or so what we were seeing. So sadly, although there is a small amount of video recording of the raid in Invincible, we just don't know what happened. But what we do know is that the Sea Dart system hit two aircraft at 50 feet at about 15 and 7 miles, and that is well in excess of its design performance. So we were very pleased with the system, and it certainly was encouraging. Our great disappointment was that if you look through a lot of the initial press reports and stories and books and things about the Falklands, you won't find this incident written up on the lines of, okay, they succeeded twice, but the third time they were thoroughly trounced. And I think that's a pity. And I complained hotly to various people of defence journals that it's not fair to damn the Type 42s when, okay, they failed on two occasions, but they certainly succeeded on the third, which isn't all that bad. So we felt very pleased with ourselves. We rather hoped we wouldn't have to do it again, because we might not be so successful the second time. But we felt that the system had been vindicated and had worked very well. And in a future incident, we were to yet again prove that the Sea Dart system worked to its design performance. So the 30th of May will always be a day in my life, and I will always be grateful for Paddy Elsa Allen for calming my nerves with a glass of whiskey.
Did anything happen on the 31st of May?
No. That was the last Ententard raid. It was indeed the last missile. That's why they flew the A4s with it to try and make it successful, but it had failed. Analysis since then, I think, has shown that indeed the missile did fall short. I don't think anybody hit it. My ship's company think they did. Avenger thought they did. But I'm very certain in my own mind that the missiles, it only had a range of between 22 and 28 miles, I think was fired early due to the human aspect of the Ententard observers who were keen to get rid of it, and the Argentinians don't disagree with that view, that they fired as soon as they had a target. They should have got closer, but had they would have been shot down. So you can understand why they fired at the first target they saw. They were very nervous that they were going to get attacked by Sea Dart. And, you know, we can reflect that it was an excellent raid, but it was the last. Now, we didn't know that for certain, but we were pretty sure there weren't any more. And the threat to the battle group, in retrospect, had reduced considerably. Now, had Sandy Woodward known that it was indeed the last missile, he would have been able to change the posture of the force, bring the carriers much closer to the Falklands, and that would have had a marked impact on all the other incidents that took place ashore during June. But we didn't know, and prudence was the order of the day, because the one thing that he had to ensure was that neither of the carriers got attacked. So Exeter went back on the picket line and stayed there for a few more days before being sent inshore, which was a whole another scene and quite different to the job we've been doing offshore.
What was your task meant to be inshore?
Well, the first thing we did was to be told, by this time it was clear that there was an Exocet ashore at Stanley, and a lot of ships were firing naval gunfire support for the artillery in the night time. And the Type 21s were firing a whole outfit of ammunition each night and coming back by day to replenish and getting inshore again. And the everyone was very worried that when the attack on Stanley came, there would be a need for naval gunfire support, and ships on the Stanley gun line were vulnerable to this attack from a shore-based exit. So Sandy got on to me and said, how about doing a bit of fun? And I said, all right. He said, I want you to go inshore tonight and trail your Kate along the shore off Stanley. Use your helicopter as a decoy and see if you can draw some exit fire. So I said, thank you very much. You're an old friend, and I appreciate the gesture that you would select me for this onerous task. And feeling that I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to be a decoy, but however. So we got hold of our Lynx, and we ladened it with reflectors from boats, from anything we could find, which we've made some extras to make it look like a big target. We went inshore, and at the duly appointed time, we started talking about naval gunfire support. We started to do all sort of communications in case they had good intelligence. And we flew off the aircraft, which was called Trigger for some reason, and with all its decoys, it looked pretty good. But Murphy again interfered. Murphy decided that the wind was going to blow the wrong way, and the helicopter had to fly backwards in order to appear to be doing about 15 knots on the gun line. So the pilot had an interesting 2 or 3 hours trying to represent a ship doing 15 knots up and down a gun line. With one way, he had to fly backwards, and the other way, he was fighting his way into a gale. But sadly, it didn't work. We were a couple of miles offshore, so further offshore from the helicopter, representing another ship. But sadly, nothing happened. So we went back to the task force, and the next day, by this time, there had been some Canberra raids, high-level raids, on the land forces ashore at night. And so Sandy Woodward decided to send one of the DDGs inshore to act as a sort of anti-high-level raid deterrent. And so we got sent in, and we spent nearly a week inshore doing quite a different job. And it had a number of immediate impacts. Arriving, actually, and seeing the Falklands and the land had an interesting effect on people. Here was the real thing. This is where people got sunk, and coming into the Sound the first time and seeing where the ships had been sunk and so on was salutary. But it immediately, one saw how different it was as seen from people inshore than it was from offshore. And I was struck by the fact that I knew nothing offshore about really what was going on. We, again, had been relying on the World Service to tell us what the Army were doing. And this was very frustrating because you didn't feel connected. You felt you were in a different world. But now we were right in there, helicopters flying around, boats rushing around the harbour, ships unloading, the Elk with 2,000 tons of ammunition sitting at anchor, oilers, Nordic Ferry and all the others still offloading stores, a buzz of activity all day and half the night. And we were very impressed by the sort of urgency and enthusiasm and activity going on inshore. And I called on Mike Clapp, who I knew well, and Jeremy Larkin in Fairless, and said, now look, here we are, what do you want us to do? And at last I got briefed on what was happening ashore. I knew what we were trying to achieve. I knew what their problems were. It was quite clear that they had been unable to get through, really, to the battle group some of the feel and nuances of what was going on ashore. And I was intent on trying to persuade Sandy to fly in and see for himself, because it was such an impact on me seeing for the first time what was actually going on. And eventually, when I went back out again to the battle group, I did call on Sandy Woodward and suggested he should fly in that morning, but he had decided that his place was with the battle group and stayed there. And although it's a criticism of Sandy, there's no doubt in my mind that on the 22nd of May, he should have flown in, talked to the Army, and seen what it was like, got a feel for what they required and what their problems were. And it would have put his mind at rest on many issues. There were a lot of things that, because you hadn't seen it, you just didn't understand. And most of them were that we were over-worrying about some things and not really understanding the real requirements. And it is a lesson to everybody that there's nothing like personal contact. You can talk on secure speech, you can send signals, you can know people well, but there's nothing like seeing for yourself. Now, by this time, in Carlos, there were rapiers everywhere around. There was now a DDG again, and there was the forward operating base about to be commissioned with GR3 Harriers from Hermes, based there to act as quick answer to the army to bomb people and rocket them, but also to provide a cap from inshore. Now, you appreciate that if you have a DDG with a missile system and rapiers with their missile systems and aircraft flying from inside those missile zones, there is a coordination problem. And not surprisingly, the rapiers were by this time half Air Force, half Army. The aircraft were Navy, and of course we were Navy, but we all were working on different frequencies, and some of us couldn't actually talk to each other. So my first job really was to put my signal officer training to good use and get around and try and sort out the communication problem so at least we could talk to each other. Now that could have been done a long time before and would have eased people's minds. There's nothing more dangerous than a blue on blue. And so far, so good, but we hadn't been operating the Harriers inshore, and I was very concerned that someone was going to make a mistake, particularly the rapiers, or reduce their readiness to the point where they were no longer effective in actually responding to a threat because they were so worried about the Harriers. Anyway, we got around, and Mike Clapp and I flew around the helicopter and chatted to everybody. We sorted out a few problems. We lent various people radios and got the thing humming. But my role was to be at sea at night, either off North Falkland, off the north side of West Falkland, or actually in the Sound, Grantham Sound itself, providing space to operate in order to shoot down any high-level raids. But unfortunately, apart from one night when I was off the north, a raid came into the south and I was outside range, we didn't have any joy. But I think the deterrent was successful. We spent most nights following Uganda round and round the Sound. She had decided that the rough weather offshore was just too much, and now there was a DDG there to look after her, although she was a Red Cross ship. She was inshore at night to do all the delicate operations on the wounded, and I think they were very grateful of a calm night in the Sound instead of being rocked and rolled offshore. And so we steamed around with her. We had one or two incidents during this sort of routine. One night, later on in the week, the SAS patrol on West Falkland had got into trouble and got caught. And one of them had taken prisoner, they thought. One of them had been killed. And so we were ordered to take an SBS team and stand by to insert them into Port Howard to try and rescue this fellow and carry out a spasmodic bombardment to try and provide an opportunity for this fellow to escape. So Keith Eve, who was the head spotter, came on board, and we sat off Port Howard, and he said, well, what I want you to do is to fire a few shells every now and then. So that's what we did. Now, the Mark 8 4.5 gun, made by Vickers, at that stage, was notoriously unreliable. It's a very clever gun, no human beings to push shells around, all automatic. But trying to get a 4.5 shell and its cartridge in and out of a gun and move the whole thing around is really quite an engineering feat, and it didn't work terribly well. But on this occasion, it was fantastic. And I said, oh, well, our gun will do this job perfectly. No one will ever know when the next shell's coming because we won't know when it's going because it keeps breaking down. So I said to the weapons officer, Alan Baird, now, what I want you to do is just to fire it and see how... So first, we said, right, engage, and off went the first three shells and it stopped. So he then had to run up to the turret with an ordnance artificer, open the door, put the defect right, shut the door, come down again, and we say, open fire again. This produced, during the night, we fired about 70 shells randomly, and the defect worked extremely well as a way of having a random firing. Keith Eve and I decided that the only way to spend the night was to work our way down through a bottle of whiskey, which is frightfully irregular, I'm sure, but I mean, he welcomed it, certainly. He'd had a rough time sitting in various places doing naval gunfire support and enjoyed his night on board. The SBS team included a very large black man, the Royal Marines. They were all about 6 foot tall. They were covered in weapons, they were camped in the dining room. And I went down to chat to them, and one of them said to me, how long are we going to be on board, Sophie? And I said, well, I don't know, you tell me. And they said, well, look, you know, as soon as we can get out, we'd like to get out. We're not at all happy stuck in your tin box at all. We want to get out. And I thought it was very interesting that here were these chaps who'd been inserted into the Falklands weeks before, who'd been crawling around, talking to people in Stanley, spotting for artillery, you name it, they'd been doing it, crawling around, risking their lives. And the one thing they were terrified of was being cooped up in a tin box at sea. We equally, I think, would have been equally terrified if we had to go ashore and crawl around in the dark. So it just shows that it's your environment you're used to has a direct effect on your fear and reactions. And we had all by natural time become quite used to our tin box, in fact enjoyed it. And a tin box does have enormous advantages. It carries your food and other comforts. You don't lose them when you're in a battle. But we had no luck that night, and we landed them. Now, then, during this period, we were increasingly concerned that there had been no air raid, and we were getting worried that time was ticking away and that the Argentinians would have regrouped. They knew that the attack on Stanley was about to happen. They must have been aware that Fire Brigade was being moved forward. The Scots Guards had already gone forward. The Welsh Guards were waiting to go. And so we were beginning to get more and more concerned that a raid was due. Our biggest problem, being inshore, although we had a missile system, we had no means of knowing what was happening at low level. Our radar was being blocked out at about 3,000 feet by the hills and the mountains and the land. And so we knew the raids were coming in at about 100 feet, so we knew we wouldn't see them. And one of the most extraordinary things about the whole operation was that nobody had loaded in the force a radar to be put on a hill with some controllers who could set up a forward air low warning system. This would have been invaluable. And it wasn't as if we didn't know about it. The US Marine Corps had this system and practiced it in NATO exercises. We were well aware of the limitation, but somehow the Navy and the Army had become blinded, really, by the philosophy that you will always have the Air Force flying AW, you will have radars ashore on mountains and everything else, and we just had forgotten the basic lesson of making sure that you have adequate warning. And not just to fight, but to alert people, so that they're stood to and responsive. So I was getting increasingly concerned, but by now the Harrier strip was in embryo form. They'd done some practice takeoffs and landings, and it was beginning to work, and we were beginning to feel confident that if there were a raid, we'd be able to use all our assets to some advantage. Well, the next morning, the first thing happened. It was a lovely, beautiful morning, like a crisp, clear Scottish day. And the Falklands are just like the Hebrides. Beautiful day. And we detected two aircraft coming very high level at about 100 miles. We delayed lock-on for some time because we didn't want them to be frightened off. We wanted to hack these two. And we assumed that they were reconnaissance, which indeed they were. They were, in fact, two Learjet with a senior Air Force officer flying one of them, coming to see what was going on in the Falklands, photograph it, and gain intelligence for another raid.